I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Well, enough is enough, and it's time for a change.
That's right. Enough is enough, and it's time for a change. In U.S. Foreign Policy says are not one, but two guests on this edition of Parallax Views. First up, retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel L. Davis. If you're unfamiliar, he blew the whistle on the disaster of the Afghanistan war many years ago during Obama's surge. And he now serves as a senior fellow and military expert at Defense Priorities. The conversation we have goes in many different directions. We discuss the airport attack in Kabul and the U.S. cooperation with the Taliban against ISIS-K during the evacuation, as well as the need for a more diplomatic approach to foreign policy. Lieutenant Colonel Davis also pushes back against figures like Leon Panetta and H.R. McMaster, who he says are addicted to war in their desire to stay in Afghanistan longer. All that and more in that conversation. And then we follow that up with Ted Galen Carpenter, a regular contributor at both antiwar.com and The National Interest. He is also a senior fellow for defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. We'll be talking with him about the lessons we should be learning from Afghanistan and the need for some really drastic changes in how U.S. foreign policy is carried out today. But first up, retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis joins us for a broad conversation about Afghanistan and U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to Parallax Views, a longtime contributor to antiwar.com and also writes for The National Interest, works at the Cato Institute. Ted Galen Carpenter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine and wish that I was dealing with a better U.S. foreign policy and not such miserable execution.
I wanted to talk about that really briefly first. A lot of my listeners and me personally come from, a more progressive or a left-wing background, but we're all still very anti-war and very much critical of the foreign policy blob. Do you think that progressives that are anti-war and libertarians can sort of come together on this issue?
Well, I certainly hope so. I would think this would be the basis for a rather broad coalition. There's certainly enough blame to go around with regard to the Afghanistan fiasco. And I would think instead of tolerating the people who are seeking partisan advantage, who are trying to blame shift, try to put the blame on somebody else, anybody else, on political adversaries, rather than examining what really has happened and what that says about a very defective U.S. foreign policy generally, not just in South Central Asia.
So in regards to Afghanistan, there's so many things we could cover, but where do you think U.S. foreign policy went wrong when it comes to, I would say, not just Afghanistan, but we look at what has happened in Iraq. We look at what has happened in Libya with Gaddafi being gone. It seems like a lot of our foreign policy decisions have come back to bite us in the butt. I know that Ron Paul calls that blowback, and so does the CIA.
Indeed, it does seem that way. And I think the fundamental error that numerous administrations have made is they think the United States is so powerful and so virtuous that we can forcibly remake other societies, and that that effort will not be resented by the people involved. They will go along with our nation-building enterprises, with our forcible regime change wars, and so on. And what U.S. policymakers refuse to admit is that people around the world really resent imperial interventions. They don't like being ruled by outsiders, even if they are not particularly fond of certain domestic factions. The one thing that will unite an otherwise diverse resistance is resentment at being bullied around by foreigners. The U.S. has not learned that lesson. We have spent decades making the same mistakes over and over and over.
Now, in the national interest, you have a relatively recent article, I believe August 23rd, U.S. credibility not seriously damaged by Afghanistan failure. In the media right now, we're seeing all these attacks from all the usual suspects, the sort of supporters of what has been called the DC foreign policy blob, the Max Boots, and all these type of people saying this is damaging to the credibility of the U.S. You know, what China is just licking their lips right now. How do you respond to those sort of criticisms?
Well, first of all, I would say the United States certainly should be a lot more selective about putting its credibility on the line. But having said that, Afghanistan was always a sideshow. The main issues that involve U.S. credibility are the main security commitments made by Washington with respect to Europe and East Asia, primarily. And anyone who, for example, who confuses an implicit commitment to defend Taiwan, much less the explicit commitments to the NATO allies and to Japan, would be making a terrible blunder. I've seen some things in the media about elements of the Chinese press, which, of course, the press is controlled rather thoroughly by the Chinese government, and mocking the United States for Afghanistan and saying, oh, the Taiwanese better realize that the United States would abandon Taiwan, and Taiwan doesn't have adequate domestic support. It would collapse. If Chinese leaders truly believe that, they are courting disaster, because the United States, I believe, whether wisely or not, would fight for Taiwan, and the Taiwanese are going to fight against being absorbed into what they regard as an alien one-party state. So I hope Beijing does not make that blunder. But some of the people in the United States who are insisting that Afghanistan has destroyed U.S. credibility, and now we're going to have all these challenges, they are feeding that kind of delusion on the part of certain foreign leaders.
Now, something that's interesting is I've noticed a lot of people, of course, are comparing this to Saigon and Vietnam. And also, I do see people on the left and libertarian ends that are opposed to imperialism saying all of this is a sign of U.S. decline, or the decline of imperial hubris. I think, though, that like the sort of Max Boot characters that are saying, you know, this has destroyed all U.S. credibility, I think that may be foolhardy to announce that too quickly, because, you know, we came back from Vietnam, and that seems to be, for me, the elephant in the room. I mean, people thought it was the end of the world when we got out of Vietnam, but it wasn't. And maybe this will be similar to that.
It depends on how U.S. policymakers react to the disaster in Afghanistan. And I think that is the correct word for it. If we try to pursue similar missions elsewhere, we're going to end up with a very similar result. And if our policymakers don't learn from their mistakes, which they haven't so far, we could be in for a very rough patch. I've said that there might be the headline for an article coming up, Saigon 1975, Kabul 2021, Baghdad 2024, because we've made a lot of the same mistakes in Iraq that we made in Vietnam and Afghanistan. And the situation there is a lot more tense than U.S. officials are letting on, and the ever-trusty cooperative U.S. media is letting on. So that could be the next bruising lesson for U.S. policymakers. I hope they learn the correct lessons this time and really revamp U.S. foreign policy, get out of the regime change nation-building mission entirely, stop doing that. It's making enemies around the world. It's bleeding the American people, both financially and literally. And we need a new foreign policy at this point, not just one that tries to refurbish the existing policy.
What do you think the new U.S. foreign policy could look like? If you could, change some of the policies we see today coming out of the blob, what would the big changes be?
Number one, stop trying to run the affairs of other countries, countries in many cases that involve societies we don't even begin to understand. They're very, very different from us. Let those people run their own affairs. Stop needlessly making enemies. The second lesson is that there are a lot of credible economic and strategic actors in the world. Unlike Madeleine Albright's comment that the United States is the indispensable nation, in fact, there are a lot of capable actors, most of whom have a vested interest in trying to maintain a reasonable degree of stability and order in their respective regions. So the United States does not have to do it all, even in regions that U.S. leaders believe are strategically and economically very important to the United States. The European countries, through the European Union or some other enterprise, can handle the security of Europe and the surrounding area. The European Union has a collective population greater than the United States. It has quite credible military forces and can build more if it chooses to do so. It has a larger collective economy, a larger collective population than the U.S. Similar with Japan. Japan can play a much larger role in East Asia, perhaps with the Indo-Pacific region in cooperation with India. Both of those countries have an interest, at least in limiting China's power. So the United States does not have to act like it's the only player in the international system that doesn't have nefarious goals. I'm reminded, the U.S. attitude really does remind me of the comment that President Theodore Roosevelt's daughter, Alice, made about her father. She said, you know, he is so egotistical that when he attends a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he attends the christening, he wants to be the baby. And when he attends the funeral, he wants to be the deceased. That summarizes the attitude of America's policy elite. They want the United States to do everything and especially be in charge of everything. That was an unrealistic attitude before. It is absurdly unrealistic in the 21st century.
For me, I think we have moved into a post-Cold War order. I think that we're moving towards a very multipolar world in a lot of ways. And, you know, the thing that I always get when you start saying these things, especially as a journalist or someone in media, people always push back and say, That just sounds like isolationism to me. How do you respond to the isolationism snarl word? Because I don't think we're for completely isolating from the world and giving up on diplomacy.
No, I've never advocated the United States becoming a hermit republic. And nor does anyone else in the realism and restraint camp advocate that. Isolation is the most meaningless, overused cliche in foreign policy discussions. It just is an attempt to intimidate people who understand and dare to say the United States is strategically overextended and the United States is making blunder after blunder after blunder in foreign policy. And it's time to make fundamental changes. And that change needs to be centered around doing far less militarily in the world than we have been doing for a very long time. Doesn't mean we retreat from the world. Doesn't mean we do not have meaningful economic connections or meaningful cultural connections. Of course we do. Diplomacy is important. But we ought to stop acting as though going to war is a very casual enterprise, and we need to do it all the time to deal with all manner of issues and problems. This has been a very disastrous approach for the United States, and it's getting worse. We are becoming more and more both exhausted and hated around the world for doing this.
Now, I wanted to talk about your piece in antiwar.com, the sort of cynical blame game that is going on now. But first, I wanted to get your thoughts on going forward, how should we think about the Taliban? Because it does seem like, they are trying to be considered the legitimate government of Afghanistan, and we may have to deal with that being the case.
I've always been a strong believer in having cordial relations, if possible, with any regime that effectively controls a country or the bulk of a country, whether one likes that regime or not. You know, if every government was a nice, peaceful democracy like New Zealand, foreign policy would be a breeze. Foreign policy's difficulties is in dealing with cantankerous, obnoxious, and sometimes rather dangerous governments. But one has to do it. If the Taliban ends up controlling most of Afghanistan, it would be wise for the United States to try to have at least a decent diplomatic relationship with that government. It doesn't do anything to refuse to engage governments. We've tried that over and over, ever since Woodrow Wilson introduced a very selective and inconsistent moral purity test to diplomatic relations that the United States has with other countries. We refuse to recognize the government of the People's Republic of China for over 20 years before we had any engagement with them, much less official relations. That didn't work. We tried the same thing with Vietnam after the Vietnam War and the communist government uniting that country. That didn't work either. We're trying it now with Iran and in Cuba and a number of other countries. Again, a failed strategy. We shouldn't pursue the same thing with the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Again, for heaven's sakes, let's learn from our mistakes.
So in regards to the cynical campaign to scapegoat Joe Biden for the Afghanistan debacle, you wrote that on August 24th. That's at antiwar.com. I don't think you're saying that Biden isn't up for criticism. You know, there are no sacred cows. There shouldn't be, at least when it comes to our politicians. But what are we talking about when we sort of talk about the blame game? Where has Biden got things wrong? But where has he also maybe got things right and it's taking too much flack?
No, I think that's a very good question. And yes, I am not exempting Joe Biden from the blame for the outcome of the Afghanistan mission. After all, the execution of the withdrawal was absolutely dreadful, incompetent. You could even say the U.S. should have kept the Bagram Air Base for that should have been the last step in the withdrawal, not one of the first. That would have been obvious to evacuate people using that facility instead of trying to use the airport at Kabul. Advising Americans and others to leave Afghanistan before the U.S. troops departed. That, admittedly, that's not exactly an expression of confidence in the Afghan government the U.S. was backing, but it would have been prudent. Would have gotten, again, people out much sooner. But while Biden bears blame for that, so many others are even guiltier of the fiasco that Afghanistan has become.
I just wanted to add to that really briefly. One thing I've noticed is we're seeing George W. Bush pop up in the media right now, giving his opinions on how horrible this withdrawal has been. And I'm thinking to myself, he got us into this mess.
Yes. That's the kind of thing that I think simple decency should dictate that he remain silent. He is the one who started all of this, not just the initial intervention to go after Al-Qaeda. One can make a decent case for that, given the 9/11 attacks. But he perpetuated the mission. His administration transformed it into a vague counterinsurgency nation-building mission. Other parties deserve their share of the blame. Obama continued that mission, despite indicating he was going to get the U.S. out. And he intensified the nation-building aspect. Trump, even more so, knew and said that Afghanistan was a failed and unnecessary war. But did he pull the troops out? No, he did not. And finally, he made an agreement with the Taliban to have a withdrawal of U.S. forces. But that was very, very late in the game. And to some extent, that agreement bound Joe Biden's hands. Nevertheless, I think Biden could have done better, a lot better, with the execution. So again, there is so much blame to go around. No administration is exempt or should be exempt from responsibility for the failure of this mission.
Now, before we close out, we've been going for about maybe 15 to 20 minutes now. I'm curious if there are people listening to this conversation that are only just beginning to get interested in foreign policy discussion. I have a lot of younger listeners from the university I live near. What would you say that you would want them to get out of this conversation that we've been having?
I'd say the number one thing is to rethink assumptions, be skeptical about what U.S. leaders are saying about any given issue in foreign affairs, and especially if there is a big propaganda campaign on to generate public support, generate public panic to support military interventions. Be very, very skeptical of that kind of effort and be extremely critical when you read or listen to accounts in the mainstream media. Far too many of them have been little more than megaphones for official hawkish U.S. policies. I think the mainstream media, by and large, has been a disgrace when it comes to coverage of international issues, and especially U.S. security policy. It really has done a thoroughly inadequate job of scrutinizing that. I have a book that will be coming out next year with the title Unreliable Watchdog, The News Media and U.S. Foreign Policy. And it covers a period of better than 50 years. And the track record for journalists generally in the mainstream media is a pretty dreadful one.
Why is it like that, just out of curiosity? Well, why is the media so in bed with this foreign policy blob?
I think there are lots of reasons. Many of the journalists share the bias in favor of a highly activist U.S. foreign policy. Many of them have drunk the Kool-Aid and truly believe that U.S. military intervention abroad is usually a force for good, not evil. Part of it is careerism. If you want to get ahead and be part of the top tier of the media, it does not help to be an iconoclast, to be criticizing U.S. foreign policy constantly. For one thing, officials favor journalists who are cooperative. They will give nice exclusive interviews and other tidbits of information to those journalists. If you're critical of U.S. policy, that tends to be a way for early career obscurity. And I think a lot of journalists have learned that the hard way. There's a lot of money involved. The military-industrial complex engages in a lot of advertising in the mainstream media. Some of these corporations with defense connections even own portions of the media.
Well, a lot of the journalists.
There's no single cause. But the result is the same. The media are not nearly as critical of U.S. foreign policy decisions as they need to be.
I just wanted to add to that, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but a lot of the journalists and pundits we see in the major outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times, a lot of them belong to think tanks, national security think tanks, and it's not even included in the op-eds most of the time. We're not even notified of that. And you have to wonder, it's like, if they're from these think tanks, do they have a certain agenda to push? Also, are they getting defense contractor money? Things like that. So I think that's important. Final note here, I also wanted to ask you, with regards to going forward, I feel like the sort of broad coalition that we're seeing forming around, as you said, realism and restraint, we see it with the Quincy Institute. This is a progressive, conservative, and libertarian coalition that we see growing. Are we in for the fight of our lives with a very angry DC foreign policy blob or a DC foreign policy establishment right now? And how do we keep up the good fight?
The answer is yes, because the defenders of the current policy do feel under pressure now. Maybe for the first time since the latter stages of the Vietnam War, that they're feeling this, that their dominance could be overturned, that there is a lot of public disillusionment out there. There are a lot of policies that have turned out so badly that it's impossible for them, or at least extraordinarily difficult for them, to deny that reality. And the more peace-oriented factions are getting better organized and somewhat better funded. So this is now a meaningful foreign policy debate. They don't have the field to themselves, or largely to themselves, as they have through most of the post-Cold War era and the Cold War era.
And I would say they also don't have a lot of the American public on their side. I mean, a lot of the American public still supports the withdrawal. So, you know, I think that's good news. There was also one more thing, and I promise to let you go. I know I kept you on a little bit longer. I just wanted to ask, you mentioned when we first went into Afghanistan, there was a case to be made for going in. For me, I'm just curious. I feel like, you know, you can make a case that we should have done something, we should have gotten bin Laden, but a full-scale military occupation of a country for 20 years seems like it was just insane to do.
That was way out of line. Again, a very limited, relatively brief, punitive mission to go after Al-Qaeda, and especially the Al-Qaeda leadership, I believe was justified in light of 9/11. Again, we can get into a larger discussion about whether U.S. foreign policy overall in the Middle East led to the rise of groups like Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks. I firmly believe that the policy did exactly that. But once the attack occurred, I believe the U.S. did have to respond. But it needed to be a very limited, focused response. That's not what we got in Afghanistan.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Hopefully people will support your work and also the work of people like Quincy Institute, antiwar.com, and others fighting the good fight against the blob. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
Can access the Cato Institute website at www.cato.org. And my section of the website contains all of the books and articles and interviews that I've had. So that's over a more than 3-decade period. There's a lot of material there. I think that would be a good introduction. There are also other very good scholars at Cato, including my colleague, Doug Bandow, who has done terrific work on foreign policy for a very long time.
Doug's actually a friend of the show. He's been on twice now. So I love what you guys are doing, and I really appreciate it. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.
Hey there, Parallax E's listeners. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. Please be sure to keep up with his work at Defense Priorities and follow him on Twitter. Many thanks to Matthew Ho, another great military whistleblower, for helping to arrange this interview. Very much appreciate it, Matthew. And now we move on to our second conversation. This time, Ted Galen Carpenter of the Cato Institute, and also a regular contributor to the National Interest and Antiwar.com, joins us to discuss further the need for a change in U.S. foreign policy in light of the Afghanistan debacle. I think in this conversation, for some reason, I said debacle. I am a butcher of the English language. That's what we do here in Pittsburgh, PA, apparently. So my apologies for that. But in any case, I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. I think Ted Carpenter has a lot to offer in terms of analysis and thinking when it comes to the need for some very necessary revamping of U.S. foreign policy, or at least that's my and his opinion and the opinion of a lot of our listeners, and I think Ted makes a good case in the conversation that follows. So let's get right to it with Ted Galen Carpenter. Welcome to Parallax Views, retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis of Defense Priorities. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on your show.
So I wanted to have you on the program because I think you have a lot of insights into Afghanistan. For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, could you give a little bit of your background when it comes to the military and Afghanistan, just generally?
Yeah, sure. I'm a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army. Started off as a private in 1985 in the Cold War, then was commissioned as an officer, went to Desert Storm as a lieutenant, and fought in the Persian Gulf War there. And then in 2005, 2006, went to my first deployment into Afghanistan. Went back to Iraq in 2009 and then back to Afghanistan a second time in 2010, 2011. And really, that's where I got a lot of the observations, firsthand experience that really informed a lot of my decisions on Afghanistan. And a lot of my observations were based on, you know, considerable firsthand observation of what was really going on the ground there.
So when it comes to the withdrawal, should this have happened sooner? And also, what really, for you, in your opinion, what went wrong with how we handled Afghanistan, not just maybe with the exit, but more generally?
Yeah, without hesitation, I'll tell you that we should have withdrawn. Actually, even backing up a little bit, we should not have done the surge that Obama ordered, the two surges he did in March and then in basically in December of 2009. I argued hard that we should not do those because they had almost no chance to succeed. But many in the military hierarchy, especially at the general officer level, were very emphatic that they could succeed and convinced President Obama that they could, as we have, you know, since discovered. But once it became clear throughout the period of the surge that it was not going to accomplish the objectives that we set out, then Obama should have done what he said he was going to do, which is to withdraw from Afghanistan. He actually had a plan in place for us to get out before he left office in 2016. He was supposed to have it down considerably by 2014 and then get out by 2016. If he had done that, if he had stuck with his guns and followed his instincts at the time, then the withdrawal would have been profoundly better than what we had. The Taliban at the time owned maybe 6% of the outlying districts at the time. The government owned almost all the rest. We could have withdrawn in complete order on a time schedule of our own and coordinated with all of our allies, done for very professionally. And at the end of the day, there would still have been an Afghan government in place and an Afghan military that was viable and would at least have had a chance, though it still would have been very iffy if they would have succeeded long term. But at least then there would have been a chance. Instead, what we did was Obama, first of all, punted and he said, nope, not going to do it. We're going to keep that. He's just going to throw it off to the next administration, which was Trump. Now, Trump entered in 2017 saying that he wanted to get out. And in fact, with some of the insider accounts, that was exactly what he planned to do. He wanted to get out. And there's this famous quote in I believe it's Bob Woodward's book, Fear, where Trump said what he thought about Afghanistan, that it was not worth it. It was just like the Vietnam War. There's no American interest involved. We should get out. And it's so ironic that he was dead spot on. I mean, there hadn't been a better analysis of what really the circumstances were, but he was talked out of it mainly by his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. Jim Mattis, also the Secretary of Defense, was heavy on that. And then politically with Lindsey Graham, all three of those together was just too much for Biden or President Trump to overcome. He instead escalated a little bit, but didn't get out. Now, he then had another shot to get out toward the end of his administration, but he decided to allow the next administration to complete what he started in February of 2020. Had Biden just followed the same path that Trump set out to include the exact dates and started doing it when we left, we still would have been in better shape because the Taliban still had none of the provincial capitals at that time. And we probably almost certainly would have been able to get out on time. So instead of being forced out with the Taliban literally waiting to walk on the airfield with the last plane pulled out, like we saw in, you know, kind of to our shame overnight, we would have been able to leave completely under our own timeline and our own circumstances, would have been able to get everybody out who wanted to get out. There wouldn't have been anyone left behind. And there still would have been an Afghan government military in place, though they probably would have collapsed within 6 months at the latest then. So the best answer would have been back in 2014. And the worst answer is the way we did it right here.
And also, I mean, maybe this is going too far putting it this way, but, you know, I almost feel like we were systemically, you know, not told the truth or even to go further, lied to about Afghanistan. I mean, we have the Afghanistan papers and it seems like we were very much misled.
Yeah, well, and I've been quite outspoken about echoing exactly what you've said, that the truth was known on the ground all the way through. I mean, from 2009 onward, our senior leaders knew what was going on the ground. In fact, before the Afghan papers, the WikiLeaks was revealed some of the documents inside. One of the most damning was by then Ambassador Eikenberry, who sent a note to Obama just before the, and I think it was November. It was November of 2009. And he had this lengthy secret document that said, don't surge. I'm against it. It's a bad idea. And then he laid out very detailed reasons why, every one of which were accurate. But then Obama decided to do it. And then the very next month, 1 month later, he goes in front of U.S. Congress and says, it's a great plan. I'm all for it. I'm completely supportive, et cetera. Even though he knew it wasn't going to work and he was against it, instead of saying, I'm against this, I can't support this, I resign, I'm going to just resign my commission. Instead, he just flips over and says, oh, yeah, it's a great idea. He lied about it. That's the bottom line. He lied. And then the Afghan papers, as you pointed out, just illuminated a great many more. In 2012, I came out with an article in the Armed Forces Journal, which was covered by the New York Times at the time, that said, look, everything that you're being told is a lie. The senior leaders are telling you this in public, and here's what's going on the ground and in private. So I told people publicly what was really happening on the ground and how this war was we were going to lose if we didn't make changes. Instead, our senior leaders, and when they went to a Pentagon press relief after my article was published, and they asked the senior general in charge of the Afghan forces that happened to be at the Pentagon at the moment, they said, what do you think about it? What Davis said, is he true? Is it right? And he said, that's one guy's opinion, but we're very confident in our assessment of things. And of course, you see how it worked out. I mean, everything I warned about came to pass. And yet this guy was one of just many, because General John Allen, it was maybe even worse, because he claimed that we had won in 2013. Instead, things were continuing to fall apart even at that time. Yet he's telling everybody that's what success looks like, which was just crazy. And it continued on. Instead of being honest with the American people, instead of saying, hey, this just didn't work. We're not going to be able to succeed here. We're going to just get out of here with the best deal we can get and do the best we can to help the Afghans survive our withdrawal. Instead of that, we kept lying and saying things are on the improvement. We're getting better. The Afghan government is getting less corrupt. Their military is getting more powerful. They're defeating the Taliban, none of which was ever true. Well, you can keep that lie up long enough when you have a lot of American troops there, but the rot that was in the Afghan government, corruption and their military, was so pervasive that at some point, then the lie can't be covered anymore. And that's the ugly truth that we saw expose itself when the Taliban literally walked across Afghanistan and the Afghan government military disintegrated before them. They didn't even win a military victory so much as everyone capitulated before them. They didn't fight for any of the major cities. And now then we can't keep the lie up anymore, because it's now staring us in the face with the Taliban owning all of Afghanistan. But here's the thing that's just kind of adding insult to injury to me, is that all of these generals that and Bush included, that lied us into this, they're the ones that are going on all over the television and the talk shows and everything else, explaining why the failure came about, pointing a finger at the guy who got us out, the one guy who finally acknowledged reality and got us out. They're trying to pin all the blame for this on him, as though if he hadn't withdrawn, everything would be fine, which was never going to be the case. But it's just disappointing that the people who did the most lying are now getting credit for pointing out someone else's faults.
I actually wanted to ask about that. I was looking at your recent, I think, op-ed in The Guardian about, these people like Panetta, Leon Panetta, and McMaster, basically saying, no, we need to stay in. They were saying this at the final hour. We're out now. I don't know if that can be changed, but what do you make of this? Or do we just have people that are addicted to war and the barrel of a gun as a solution to everything?
Yes, that's 100% the case. That there is a whole generation of leaders. And it started on 9/11, or in the aftermath of 9/11, because everyone was afraid and everybody wanted to show that we were tough. And President Bush was using all that tough cowboy language. And the military was, looking like it was doing great things, with that rapid victory in Afghanistan. And then at least the initial rapid victory in Iraq, in Operation Iraqi Freedom in March 2003, and the immediate aftermath of that, there was a great deal of hubris of like going, we won the Cold War. We kicked ass on Al-Qaeda. Now then we were, reforming the Middle East in our image, and everybody was, this euphoric moment, kind of getting drunk on the power. Well, it was all based on fiction and on a foundation of sand. It's not going to sustain that, because things just don't work that way in the world. And, the fundamentals for a successful, number one, Iraq should never have been fought. We now know that, of course, for a fact. And the Afghanistan situation, we should have left in 2002, not stay there forever. And then things would have been better. But we were addicted to war. And now then everybody, with Bush turning into the Axis of Evil speech in January 2002, now that we've added Iran, Iraq, and North Korea to the enemy list. And so now that we're all always, you know, poking them and talking about going to war with almost all of those we did with Iraq. But the other two, we've constantly been at the threshold of war. You know, and now we're doing the same thing with China and Russia. We're ramping it up and we're using that same aggressive military first operations there. Now, we lost this war in Afghanistan, and it's a national shame, but it hasn't cost our security anything. It wasn't at risk before. But if you keep this lying to the American people and tell them one thing when something else is the truth, and you keep on with this militaristic leading with the barrel of a gun first, the next time it might not be somebody who can't actually hurt us. Maybe it is China. Maybe we fight China over Taiwan, something we should never do because we can't win that. But yet I see our military leaders telling people, oh yeah, we can, we're ready for that, which is simply not true. And if you follow that hubris and we actually get into a war and lose it, I mean, a real war, like ships sank to the bottom of the sea, planes knocked out of the sky, thousands of Americans killed, and we lose, now then you've got a real problem on your hands. And that's one of the things that animates me so much, is that the price of this continued mentality could be catastrophic for America.
You know, this is probably a very big question, and maybe we don't have enough time to answer it fully, but I guess the thing I always wonder about is, how did we get to this point of this mentality being so pervasive, you know, that war before diplomacy, and, you know, we may have to mislead the public on these things sometimes. How did we get to this point where there is so much hubris within the system?
Yeah, 9/11 fundamentally changed everything. Because up until that point, we were doing lots of, you know, diplomacy was, there was lots of debate left and right about what we should do, what we shouldn't do. And more or less, we were relatively straightforward and honest about it. I mean, the issue of Clinton going into the Balkan areas, I mean, there was a lot of debate about that. Should we do it? Should we not? He did keep it kind of small scale, but I mean, it was kind of on the up and up. People knew what we were doing, even if we didn't agree with it. But once 9/11 came, all the inhibitions went off. And now then we're just saying we're going to do whatever the hell we want to do, you know, out of initial thought to keep our people safe. And of course, they appreciated that initially. But, you know, it just went on, you know, steroids and to our harm, because, you know, then, you know, of course, then all the issues with the Patriot Act and all this, where our rights were being taken away and, you know, some of our Fourth Amendment for privacy, a lot of the stuff we know now from whistleblowers, from the NSA, et cetera, all of that spawned out of this. And it's the problem is, not only has no one been held to account, but these people who have done all this stuff and who have lied so much have been rewarded tremendously for it. Like General Scaparotti, the one I just told you about that told everybody that he disagreed with me and that his ideas were right. Well, he was dead wrong. We now know for a fact. But he was rewarded with a promotion and was eventually given a command of U.S. forces in Europe. I mean, a very prestigious position. General Terry, I think it was John Terry, was in charge of the Future Combat System program that was canceled in 2009 because it was disastrous. He was promoted. He was put in charge, a three-star general in charge of a corps in Afghanistan, which of course also failed. And yet now he's got this very prestigious position in the defense contractor world, which of course happens all the time. H.R. McMaster, he's been shown to be disastrously wrong on almost all the issues since he became national security advisor. And yet he gets this big book deal. He's on all these prestigious boards and all that. They get rewarded. Now, when you see your peers getting rewarded and getting hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, especially when you get on these boards, what are you going to do? You're going to follow in behind that and continue it on. And until we change the dynamics to where there's not a reward for being wrong, we're going to continue getting this.
So just to play devil's advocate, I know that there's a lot of people that say, well, we shouldn't have left Afghanistan. What about the people of Afghanistan? What happens to them now? And we've heard a lot of excuses made for why we should stay in Afghanistan. What are your answers to the sort of critics who say we should stay forever?
Yeah, no, because unless you're willing to say I am now going to commit the United States of America and the U.S. Armed Forces to become the defense forces for Afghanistan. And we're going to spend all of our tax dollars permanently on their defense, fighting their war, their civil war for them. And we're going to continue to spill American blood on the behalf of the government, the corrupt government in Kabul. I say, hell no. I'm not going to spend not one more American life was worth the corrupt government in Kabul. And our security was not at risk. Our security was not threatened by the existence of Afghanistan. Even if the Taliban's in charge of it, it still isn't going to be, because we don't keep ourselves safe because of troops on the ground. We keep ourselves safe because of our extremely powerful intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance ability, and the ability to project power to strike direct targets to America, no matter where they are in the world. We can do that without having any troops on the ground. That's why we haven't had any major terrorist attacks since 9/11, not because of a handful of troops on the ground in a couple of countries, but because of our tremendous ISR strike capability, it's called, and our substantially improved cooperation between federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, and our engagement with the intelligence services of our friendly nations around the world. That's what keeps us safe on an hourly basis on this never blinking eye that we have, not a few troops on one piece of terrain in one part of a very ungoverned world where there's millions of square miles of similar territory. So we should not have stayed in Afghanistan, because it's not in our interest. And why in God's name would we want to continue to sacrifice American blood for something that's not in our interest and in behalf of a corrupt government?
So we should really be questioning this line that we're hearing, I think, that if we don't stay in Afghanistan, I believe it was there's that Republican Congressman, Fen Crenshaw, was saying, if we don't stay there, we don't need to nation build, but if we don't stay there, then they'll attack us again. This line you're saying is completely off.
It's just unsubstantiated by reality. And it shows a shocking lack of understanding of how we keep ourselves safe. Because what he would have to explain, for that to be true, you would have to explain how the fact that since at least 2011, when I was there, and certainly before that, but every year since, that there has been massive sections of Afghanistan that were completely beyond our ability to even influence, much less control. So the Taliban had complete freedom of reign. They therefore have had this ability already in Afghanistan. So this is nothing new now, because we've withdrawn. It's simply made something that was this big. So, but they still had the capacity anytime to do that. If that's what was going to cause terrorism to thrive, it would already have done it. But he also has to explain how in the world somehow that having this magic piece of dirt in Afghanistan is going to be great for terrorists around the world, when all of the ungoverned spaces in Syria, all the ungoverned spaces in Iraq, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Niger, and in a bunch of other places around the Middle East and in all over the continent of Africa. I'm talking millions of square miles. How is it that those areas haven't turned into this hotbed of terrorist activity against the United States? Because if a terrorist wanted to do something, they're certainly not going to go into a place where there's American troops with counterterrorism capabilities. They're going to go where there's not any threat of that. And of course, that's what we've had. And yet we've still kept ourselves safe. So what he's saying and what everybody like that is saying does not stand up to logic and just a plain examination of what's really going on the ground.
There were just two more things I wanted to ask you about. First is, I feel like what happened at the Kabul airport with the attack, I feel like there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of just not understanding what happened. People are confusing ISIS-K and the Taliban. What should people know about that attack and what happened?
Yep. Now, it's a really important thing to understand, because it's also being used as evidence of why the terrorist threat's going to go up and why we maybe shouldn't have left, et cetera. But look, here's the real deal. ISIS-K is a wannabe offshoot of the ISIS that was in Iraq and Syria. They're not directly controlled. They're just basically saying, hey, we like your name, we're going to use it here. And the personnel is drawn from the most radical elements of the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban, i.e., people that are so violent that the Taliban is not violent enough for them. So they've pulled off. Now, they've been at direct conflict with the Taliban ever since they formed And they've never grown much beyond where they are now. So they've been at 1,000, 2,000 really for years. And because they don't have an ideology that's going to attract a lot of people, they also don't have the ability to project power. The only way that they can kill Americans and harm our interests is if we're sitting on the ground in the middle of Afghanistan to where they have access to us. Now that we have pulled that away, they're no longer a threat to us because they can't get to us. And the minute that they try to like leave the country, or if they want to, and they want to try to actually go somewhere, now they run right into the teeth of the strength of our counterterror capability, this, you know, global network I was telling you about, which has done a tremendous job at identifying terrorist threats as they are processing and interdicting long before they get here. And so for that reason, ISIS-K is really meaningless, and we have plenty of ways to defend ourselves against them or any of the other 70 named terrorist groups that we have on our watch list that we monitor around the world.
Now, what was interesting after the attack, we had some generals talking about, I believe, how, you know, they were working, the U.S. was, you know, this sounds strange, but we were sort of working to prevent another attack and using the Taliban intelligence to help with that. And I know a lot of people were trying to exploit that, saying, oh, we're working with the Taliban now. I just saw it as, you know, you have to deal with this ISIS-K threat during the evacuations. But I guess, is this a sign of things to come when it comes to how do we deal with the Taliban going forward? Are we going to have to deal with them in a diplomatic way, I guess?
Yeah. On the situation of the cooperation, I mean, that just worked out to our advantage, like beyond my wildest hope, because what the Taliban could have done is they could have been sniping at us the whole time, you know, and shooting at us from a distance and made our final withdrawal under military pressure, which is the absolute worst case scenario and the hardest thing to conduct. Instead, they not only they weren't even passive, they actually helped provide security to prevent anybody else from getting in the way of us. So they actually helped us out because they actually made good on what they have been saying literally from day one, was that they just want the foreign forces out. So now that they showed that they actually meant that, they just wanted us out. They didn't want to keep fighting when they didn't have to. They didn't try to, you know, militarily defeat us at the airfield, which could have been possible. They may have done that, which then would have required a tremendous escalation on our part. So that was literally the worst case scenario. But it made sense for us to say, hey, if you're going to be willing to cooperate, we'll cooperate with you and we'll conduct this withdrawal as fast as possible. And then that works out for both of us. So it kept more Americans alive. After that attack, which, by the way, also killed 28 Taliban fighters, so they hated ISIS-K even more than we did, and they're continuing to go after them. But after that bombing, they moved the cordon further back away from the gates where we were to make it much harder for any future terrorists to get up in there, which proved out to be effective. Now, the second part of your question is going forward. I think that we're going to have some level of cooperation and maybe even recognition of the Taliban government, because we can't turn them into a pariah. If we do, we're going to be harming the very people that we were saying that we were trying to protect the whole time, which is the 38 million Afghan civilians and the citizens of the country, because the only way that country has been kept afloat since 9/11 has been because of the, you know, scores of billions that the international community has been pouring in there. And that's kept, you know, all these things afloat, the lights on, the gas on, the water running, the trash being picked up, all of the things that a society has to have to thrive. You know, a lot of that stuff has been because of the international community. You suddenly cut that completely off, and now then the whole economy, what little it was, is going to be just destroyed, and people are going to start starving because they won't even have food to eat. And that, we can't have that. The Taliban won. They're now the government. They're in charge of it. It's just a reality and a fact on the ground that we cannot change. So let's don't punish somebody else by saying, oh, we don't like this, so we're not going to cooperate with you. We're not even going to recognize you. I think we're going to have to just hold our nose and, you know, grit it up and do at least some level of engagement so that we, you know, don't turn them into an enemy and don't give them any reason to want to harbor any terrorists in the future, but mainly to help the Afghan people that still live there.
In closing, we've talked about a lot of different issues. We've talked about the Kabul airport attack. We've talked about the blame game. And I appreciate your being very honest and saying, you know, this isn't all on Biden. You know, we can look at George W. Bush. I wish more people were saying that. I'm surprised that George W. Bush is going around on the TV still talking about his opinions when he got us into this conflict. And also Obama shares a lot of blame. What's the one thing, though, that you would like people to get out of this conversation we've been having for the past 25 or so minutes?
I think that the ultimate lesson that needs to be learned and the thing that needs to be taken away from this is that it is way past time to reorient our foreign policy. We have got to get rid of this lead with the barrel of a gun mentality that we can compel people to do what we want. We can force them, whether it's sanctions or military power, try to compel and coerce everybody. It just doesn't work. Forget about the hubris. It doesn't work. Why would I want to continue to lose American lives, spend billions of American dollars on something that is a losing proposition? It's time to keep the strong national defense. The defense priorities is a strong advocate of the strong national defense. No one's saying gut the DOD, but let's have a military that focuses on its core mission to defend America so that if anybody attacks us, we have, you know, strong military that can keep our people safe. That's important and a responsible thing for the government to do. It's non-negotiable, it should be. But we also need to elevate diplomacy and expand our toolkit of how we deal with the world and not just have to have everything our way all the time. I mean, we should look at, there's sometimes we can do a win-win situation. It's if some other country benefits, that's actually okay as long as we benefit. And unfortunately, that's, we have just gone, we've just almost eliminated that since 9/11. So the most important thing is let's don't lie about what we're doing and let's start reorienting our foreign policy that has a chance to actually accomplish something positive for the country.
Just real quick, just to add to that, I wanted to add first, do you think Biden has really opened up a debate with this withdrawal about reorienting foreign policy? And also, how would you respond to people? I always get the accusation that those of us who are for a more realist and restraint-based foreign policy, that we're isolationists. How would you respond to those two things?
Now, that's one of the greatest weapons that the advocates of forever war have always used, because it always conjures up Munich and Hitler and all this kind of stuff. And everybody just reflexively backs off of that. So it's a great weapon to use. It's just absurd in its application because no one is saying anything about withdrawing from the world. To the contrary, that's why I'm saying let's have more engagement, but let's have smart engagement that actually has a chance to accomplish something instead of stupid engagement that all it does is harm America. So all these people who were talking about forever wars or they want to lead with the barrel of the gun are harming our country, and that needs to be exposed. So I react pretty strongly to that false charge.
And do you think that this has sort of reoriented the debate, Biden withdrawing? I feel like we have a lot of momentum now, those of us who are more voices of restraint and using the diplomatic toolbox more.
Well, I certainly hope that's the case. That's going to remain to be seen because, you know, because of the political climate is so poisoned in America right now, there's still so many, you know, just sticking with the traditional blame the other side kind of situation and defend my side deal. So right now it's kind of lost in the weeds, and, you know, everybody is wanting to blame somebody, and Republicans want to blame the Democrats and the Democrats want to blame the Republicans. But this is a we issue. And I think America needs to come to grip that we have all been a part of this problem and we all have to be a part of fixing it. So I do agree with you, though, that there is certainly some increased momentum on the side of sanity and a rational foreign policy. And I do hope that continues on.
Well, I want to thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, not just for this conversation, but also for telling the truth. Because, I mean, I have friends in PA that went to serve, and, you know, I'm sick of my friends coming back from a lot of these wars with issues, PTSD, things like that, and then being told by, you know, people who aren't even serving in the wars, we need to stay there forever. So I'm really glad that you are telling the truth. It means a lot to me and my friends in the military that have come back now. How can my listeners keep up with your work at Defense Priorities, though?
I publish everything that I do on my Twitter account, which is at Daniel L. Davis and in the number one. And so I'd be obliged if anybody goes there and follow me, and you'll be able to see all the work that I do when I share some of my colleagues' work as well.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis and Ted Galen Carpenter of the Cato Institute, antiwar.com, and the National Interest. As always, if you can, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. I should be getting an episode out within the first week of September on George H.W. Bush with These Long Wars, a blogger that you may remember from his appearances on Radio War Nerd and The Michael Brooks Show. My apologies for not getting that out in August, but the first part will be released at the beginning of September for $5 tier and above Patreon supporters. Lots of bonus content you get if you join at the $5 tier. There's also a $1 tier. If you can't afford the $5 tier, even a dollar will help. And there is the $10 and $15 tiers where you get a producer's credit, which leads us to the producer's credit shoutouts. Producer's credit shoutouts to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, Amelia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well then join those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.